Barbarian tribes of Rome, the Anglo-Saxons. Social structure of the Anglo-Saxons. Like most European tribal cultures, the Anglo-Saxons had their own form of social stratification. Their leaders were tribal chieftains who would later bear the title of king, although the term king comes from Old English, sinning, meaning chieftain. They had hereditary rights along the male line, but they didn't hold all the power, which we'll get to shortly. The king was more than just a ruler, though. He was also the head judge, possibly the high priest, and a military commander. What we today would call commander-in-chief. Of course, we have had to stress that he, because it was rare for women to officially rule over any of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. The king would most often rule until his death, after which a council of elders and high-ranking noblemen, the Witzengamot, would choose a new king from the royal family. Usually the title would go to the oldest living son of the last king, and bastard children could hold no title unless they were legitimized somehow. Of course, it would be a bastard, William the Conqueror, who would take the control of all of Britain in the mid-11th century, but that's something that comes with a whole book. The reason the term king stayed as the official title is because of its root, sin, C-Y-N-N, means family lineage. But the best term to describe it is actually the modern word that comes from kin, K-I-N. The Anglo-Saxons practiced sacral kingship, where a certain family would represent the god, and later Christian god, on earth. This ties in well with a lot of these houses claiming kingship to the supreme god Woden. With that in mind, we can see the Anglo-Saxon king as the religious figurehead, although his role might have been slightly changed with conversion to Christianity. The king was at the top, but the Anglo-Saxon society had a long list of titles for its other members. One title directly under the king was Atheling. Atheling was usually a younger prince or younger princess who were heirs apparent to the throne. However, historians believe that the title might have simply been used to distinguish any young member of the high nobility before the kings became more powerful on the island, after which it became a specific term to the royal families. Athelings also are mentioned in the works of fiction such as Beowulf, in its first few lines, no less. According to an old document dating from around 900s, if you were to kill an Atheling or harm him in any way, you would have to pay a wergeld or man price of 15,000 thrimas. That's Anglo-Saxon currency, which equaled 11,250 shillings. Each man had a wergeld, his worth in gold, which was to be paid as compensation if a crime was committed towards them. For example, typical archbishop cost as much as an Atheling when it came to the wergeld, whereas damage to the king himself was twice that amount. So Athelings were an interesting class for sure, though we can't be sure if they held any political power while their father, the king, was still alive and ruling. Some historians state that the Anglo-Saxon kings might have ruled not as monarchs, but as diarchs. In other words, a single kingdom might have been ruled over by two kings, which would make sense if one of those two would be the heir apparent and kin to the main ruler. For this reason, Athelings were venerated as highly as any king would. But Athelings were also venerated in poetry and literature. When we read about Anglo-Saxon poems, we see the term Atheling to describe good men of noble, pure hearts. Both Beowulf and Jesus are described as Athelings a few times in medieval writings. With time, however, the title was discontinued, with some forms of the term surviving in Wales as Edling, which merely described the male heir apparent to the household. Andoroman was a title that meant different things at different times. Most people would see this term and think, hey, these are the earliest earls, right? No pun intended, but of course they would be right. The title of earl was more than likely evolved from ealdorman. But we still have a similar sounding title today, alderman, someone who serves on a city council. Eldermen were actually far more influential back in the day. Namely, a typical elderman would be a member of the royal family or otherwise high nobility. Before the 8th century, they acted more or less independent from the king. However, in later years, eldermen would represent former kings of territories, which great powers took over under their control. In either of these positions, the eldermen wielded great power. They presided over taxation, local courts as well, and led their men in the battle if there was need for war. Any member of the elderman class was likely respected in community, especially if they were a former royal bloodline. In time, these men took control of vast swaths of land, some so big they would encompass the entirety of the old kingdoms. As the courts became more centralized in England and moved closer to a united kingdom, Eldermann in the south would begin to attend court meetings. Historians can't be sure if Eldermann from the north were as active in attending. All in all, this was the highest class after the king and his direct heir. Directly below the Eldermann were the High Reeves. Historians often associate this term with the old settlement of Bamberg, where they would use the term High Reeve for its own magnates and independent lords. However, there's evidence of other members of lower nobility throughout Anglo-Saxon England bearing this title. High Reeves had to respond directly to the Eldermann, but he could still lead local provincial armies independently. Reeves was one class below High Reeves, and they would directly oversee a manor, a town, a district, or anything of similar size. Before we get into what a reeve was responsible for, we should mention how land was structured in the early medieval England. Namely, if you had arable land for one household, you had a hide. 10 hides would make up a tithing, while 10 tithings formed a hundred. But it didn't end there. If you were to group several hundreds, you'd get an administrative unit called the shire. The term itself is used in place names, such as Berkshire, Cheshire, Worcestershire, Yorkshire, and so on. With all this in mind, we can see that different units of land demanded different types of reeves. The list included shire reeves, the original of the day, the sheriff, town reeves, port reeves, reeves of hundreds, reeves of manors. A typical reeve had the duty of a local policeman, job overseer, and manager. In short, he had to take care of the territory he was assigned to for his lords. The next class was the things. The thing was in the beginning a term used for military service loyal to the king. It gradually shifted into representing members of the lower class who would work on different land units, such as hundreds. They were directly under the Eldermann and Reeves, but at times the king could choose his own personal thing whom they could dispose. In addition, this king's thing, and by the way, that is spelled T-H-E-G-N, only took orders from the monarch directly. Of all these titles were titles of free men. And the lowest of these was a seol, or churl. This is a very term that gives us the name Charles and Carl. Churls cultivated land without a lot of restrictions, and their loyalty was to the king. To put it simply, they were free to farm and live their lives, unlike the classes below them. During the reign of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, the churls did not have a lot of legal trouble with their land ownerships. However, conquest of William the Conqueror, this class began to erode. At some point, the word churl began to be used as a pejorative toward the lower classes in general. However, its original meaning had nothing to do with class. It simply meant man or husband. Cotters were similar to churls, but unlike churls, they couldn't really own land. They had to rent arable land from local lords, which made them directly subservient to them. In later years, after the conquest, the cotters would work under a new class called the villeins, but different accounts lump these two classes into one because of how similar they were. Last on the list, of course, were the slaves. Officially, slavery was abolished in the UK in 1833 with the Slavery Abolition Act. However, even during the Anglo-Saxon periods, people would sentence slave traders to pay the weregild of the man they sold. It didn't matter if the man had committed a crime. The seller still had to pay the penalty. Slaves as a class in Britain at the time had no civil liberties. Before the kingdoms were established on the island, the Anglo-Saxon tribes would capture local Britons and use them for slave labor. Wars were also good opportunities to snatch a new batch of slaves, and families could even sell their own children into slavery to pay outstanding debts. This entire practice is not dissimilar from slavery during ancient Mesopotamian kingdoms or empires. Kinsmen of slaves could even buy the freedom of their captive relatives, and if the person was to become a slave due to debt, they could work it off in several years and earn their freedom back. There's evidence of slave trade going on even after 1066, despite the taxation and legal penalties. The Anglo-Saxons still sold slaves occasionally to other kingdoms on the continent. Well, that's quite a significant round of social changes. Now, next time, we'll be looking at early Christianity amongst the Anglo-Saxons. Now, the sources for this, The Germanic People, Their Origin, Expansion, and Culture, by Owens, Attila the Hun, by Worrell, The Burgundians, by Charles River, The History of the Ostrogoths, by Burns, and The History of the Vandals, by Jacobson, as well as the history of the barbarians. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, sumahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.